Our first reading is an essay entitled Climbing the White Escalator by Betsy Leondar Wright. It was published in 2004 by Common Dreams, and the author is also the co-author of a new United for Fair Economy book entitled The Color of Wealth. America is a meritocracy, my father always told me. The harder he worked, the more money he got. Clear cause and effect. From individuals' prosperity or poverty, he believed he could determine their effort and talent.
So poor black people suffering in inner cities were clearly not applying themselves.
My father had a legacy that he couldn't see, a legacy he only got because he is white. His ancestor, John Prescott, came from England in 1638. The Massachusetts Bay Colony granted him land in central Massachusetts, and he built the first sawmill there. As far as I can tell, none of his descendants have ever been poor. Some of my ancestors moved west to Ohio in the 1800s, where they may have received land under one of the Homestead Acts.
No people of color were among those granted land in the original colonies, nor in the Northwest Territories. Both land grants were government handouts closed to people of color.
My father is a World War II era veteran, and he went to graduate school on the GI Bill.
Most veterans of color were unable to access these educational benefits. The few black colleges in existence then were swamped with applicants, and most other colleges accepted whites only. Job training programs in the South were segregated and under local white control. African Americans were one-third of the World War II veterans in the South, but only got one-twelfth of the job training slots.
My parents bought our first house with the Veterans Administration mortgage.
The cheap subsidized mortgages of that era could not be used in mixed-race neighborhoods or in inner cities. Because most banks issued only government-subsidized mortgages, most World War II veterans of color had to remain renters.
My father's parents got Social Security old age benefits, which spared my father from supporting them. This enabled him to pay for my college education.
Social Security initially excluded domestic and agricultural workers, which meant that most people of color did not qualify in the first decades of the program. The minimum wage still excludes agricultural workers. The parents of today's middle-aged people of color typically had to support their own parents, and so they couldn't save for college tuition.
As easily as my parents saved for mine. Of course, effort and talent make a difference in climbing the staircase to prosperity. But for most white men, the staircase has been an escalator powered by public assistance. I saw this in my own family. My father had a relative who was unambitious, sweet, but slow-thinking. He got a middle management job and stayed in it for decades and lived in the same small house until he retired with a pension. He was carried gently up the escalator, ending up lower than my dad, who put a lot of effort into climbing and so reached upper management. That was the range for college-educated WASP men of their generation, middle management and small homes, or high-level jobs and big homes. They started in the middle of the staircase and got help to rise. Working-class men may have started at the bottom, but in that era, they had opportunities and assistance to climb upward.
Historically, for people of color, the escalator has been broken. Sometimes they had to hike up a fast-moving down escalator. No matter how hard they worked, they rarely got the same rewards as white people. Their wages were lower, and many neighborhoods and schools were blatantly and aggressively closed to them. In some eras and places, laws and violence kept them off the staircase to prosperity entirely. Federal civil rights legislation has allowed people of color to step onto the staircase, but there's no GI Bill today. The more recent government programs open to people of color, such as welfare and food stamps, have been tiny compared with the vast assets conferred on whites by the Homestead Acts and the GI Bill. And these recent programs have only helped with immediate living expenses, not college, home ownership, or other assets that provide security for coming generations. People of color have recently become homeowners in greater numbers, thanks mostly to their own savings, without the kind of substantial government assistance that white families got in the 50s and 60s.
Government boosts for white people were invisible to my colorblind father. He opposed government handouts as destroying incentives to strive, without considering the handouts his family had received. In truth, prosperity comes from a mixture of individual effort and assistance from family and government.
America won't be a meritocracy until the escalator rises at the same speed for everyone.
I ask you to rise and turn in your hymn books to 305. We're going to sing the first verse in English right now.
Good morning. My name is Erin Upchurch, and I am a founding member of New Leaf Columbus, which is a social network for LGBTQ people of color and our allies. Additionally, I am a social worker, a writer, an activist, a feminist, a partner, a daughter, and a mother to Alex and Jeremiah. I don't even notice that you're black. These are the words spoken to me by my partner early on in our relationship as we pondered which of our many differences made the most impact in our day-to-day lives. Hearing this, I was instantly drawn into my 16-year-old world in which a friend had just uttered the same. This phrase would then go on to become painfully familiar to me throughout the next 16 years or so in between. I understood the intention of their statements, likely an attempt to underscore the lack of vision regarding the color of my skin. They were trying to tell me that my brown-hued exterior made no difference in how they saw me as a person, partner, or friend. Unfortunately, such conversation did nothing more than work to erase me as I was. I imagine when others share this experience with me on one side or the other, it is an odd and awkward place to be on the receiving end, and up until recently, I never really knew how to respond. When identifying my racial or ethnic background, it is important for me to identify and or label myself as being black. I do this because my experience as a black woman fully informs every single aspect of my life. Labels, while sometimes limiting, also serve to create a lens through which others see and hear us. When posed with the consideration of when and why to speak up about race, this is what I have to say. To be blind is not helpful. I need you to see me. While you may not understand what you see, and while you may even be uncomfortable, I still need you to look, and then I need you to see. In the dictionary, there are several definitions of the word blind, yet there is one in particular that stood out to me, and that is the lacking of all consciousness or awareness. My challenge to you today is this. While you are conscious, make the choice to be aware. Don't erase me for your comfort or think you are doing so for mine. To be mute is also not helpful. I need you to speak up and speak out. The word mute refers to a speech disorder in which a person lacks the ability to speak, thus rendering said person incapable of doing so. For me, this implies a desire, yet inability to speak. So I ask, when you see injustice and inequality, are you quiet due to the inability to speak? Do you not know what to say? Or do you remain quiet simply because you can? I believe it is often the privilege of the majority that leads one to silence. When clothed in privilege, it doesn't appear that you have anything to lose, particularly when the silence provides the illusion of comfort and protection. However, I argue, in the words of the late great poet Audre Lorde, that your silence will not protect you. So what are we to do? In this postmodern melting pot of a society, we are encouraged to assimilate and become one. We have yet to discover the beauty of unity within difference. We don't know how to comfortably acknowledge one of these things does not look like the other, and we are taught to search for our similarities and push away that which may remind us of all of our individual and unique makeup. We blend and perfect fitting in. I know I did this and often still do when it comes to my speech. I'm very aware of my words and how they sound. I know the difference between sounding improper and the free use of Ebonics. When I was a child, I used to fix my lips in an attempt to make them smaller. It was as if I was a partner in the design of becoming colorless, invisible. In reality, it was me making myself and others comfortable through the disappearance of my true self. Activist and author Lonnie Ka'ahumanu concludes that assimilation is a lie. It is spiritual erasure. Approximately a week after my partner so lovingly informed me that she didn't notice my brownness, she brought up the conversation and apologized for her words. She shared that after a few days of contemplation, she realized by saying what she did, she was taking away who I am. She acknowledged the value of seeing my color and seeing me. Speaking up about race can occur in many different forms. It's acknowledging the surface characteristics of another's skin. It's taking pleasure in a different dialect or language. It's standing up against a slur or injustice. It is drinking in the sweetness of culture that stitches us all together. It is okay to be seen. It is okay to speak. We do this now and we do this tomorrow because we all deserve and desire to be seen.
Morning. My name is Bob Gordon, and I've been a member of this church for 23 years. As some of you know, I've worked extensively with the concept of unearned privilege. I'm also dealing with some kind of a sinus infection, so excuse me. Be it male privilege, heterosexual privilege, middle and upper class privilege, or in this case, white privilege, to name a few. That work has included some workshops here at the church in recent years. With very little prompting, participants in these workshops have been able to come up with quite a long list of privileges or benefits that accrue to us merely because we were born white, not the least of which is that I don't even have to think about skin color. Even now, when asked to complete the stem, I am, white is usually nowhere near the top of my list, unless I'm at a workshop on race. I will list a lot of other things before I get around to saying I'm white. And often when I do, I'll weasel out of it by saying, but I'm gay, so I don't really have all those privileges. Similarly, I've heard white women say, but I'm a woman. Or working class whites say, but I'm poor. And other groups state such partial denials as, but I'm Italian, or but I'm Jewish. This morning, however, I want to focus on a different aspect of racism, the other side of the story. Not white privilege, but what are the costs of racism to white people? We often think of racism as a problem only for people of color, something we as fair-minded and justice-seeking people should be concerned about for their sake. It is certainly true that people of color pay an astonishing price with the quality of their lives and at times with their very lives. However, the costs of racism to white people are very real, too. While they are not the same costs that people of color have to deal with, they are significant, and we have been trained to ignore, deny, and rationalize them away. What are the real costs to me, to us, as white people at least, of this system of division and exploitation? I'm going to read you a partial list of the costs of racism for whites. If you're white, as you hear each one of these, think about whether it applies to you. I don't know exactly what my European-American heritage is, or what my great-grandparents' birth names were, or what countries, regions, or cities my ancestors came from. I grew up in a neighborhood which was, as far as I knew, completely white. I did not meet people of color socially until I went to college. I grew up in a household where I heard derogatory racial terms and racial jokes. I've seen images in movies and on TV that depict Mexicans as lazy or illiterate, Asians as exotic or devious, Arabs as swarthy and fanatical, and African Americans as violent or criminal, just to name a few. I've sometimes felt that white culture was empty or non-existent or boring, and envied the solidarity that people of color seem to have. I've been nervous or anxious when encountering people of color in neutral public situations, such as an elevator or on the street. I was in a close friendship or working relationship with a person of color, which was negatively affected by racism between us or from others. I have been in a close friendship or working relationship with another white person, which was damaged by a disagreement about race or racism. I worked in an organization where people of color held more menial jobs. I have accepted unnecessary limits on my basic civil liberties because of social fears that people of color are dangerous. I have felt racial tension or noticed racism and been I've been afraid, I guess I would say, to say or do anything about it. I live or worship in a community where, for whatever reasons, few or no people of color are present, and so some of the above do not even apply. How many of these 13 examples apply to you? For your information, they come from a much longer list in Paul Kivel's book, Uprooting Racism. The ones I chose to share with you this morning are the ones that are true for me, although this is certainly not an exclusive or exhaustive list. It took me a long time to understand that racism cost me my heritage. The desire to assimilate into that so-called melting pot, a racist goal if there ever was one, made my great-grandparents and grandparents try to forget and ignore their ethnicities, their languages, their history, their connections to places of origin. My parents did not even have accurate information about where their parents and grandparents were born. In conclusion, I hope this helps you to understand that we have all paid some of the costs of racism. I think it's important to talk about race and racism, to understand the effects of institutional racism on our history, and to fight it wherever and whenever we can, for the benefit of all of us here now and in generations to come. We're going to sing the other verse of De Colores, number 305, in Spanish this time. I'm going to try to sing it into the microphone for you a little bit in Spanish, in case you have struggle with that. Thanks. De colores se visten los campos en la primavera. De colores son los pajaritos que vienen de afuera. De colores es el arco iris que vemos lucir. Y por eso los grandes amores de muchos colores me gustan a mí.
Good morning. I'm Aaron Riley. I am also a co-founder of New Leaf Columbus. And we brought some information. We left it on the greeting table in the back. So if you'd like to know more about the social network or how to join the network, there are fact sheets on the back table, the greeting table, when you first come in. I'm really pleased this morning to be able to share with you a few thoughts that are near and dear to my heart. This concept of being able to speak up about race is very important to me. I had the fortunate pleasure a few years ago to be part of the inaugural class of the African American Leadership Academy. One of the most beneficial lessons that I learned from this experience was getting comfortable in my own skin. I had to get comfortable with all the things that make me different and unique. I had to get comfortable with who I was and am as a leader. I had to get comfortable with my identity as a poor black gay man from the South. I recall thinking about my professional life and my volunteer work in the community, and how in the past I had struggled with when and why to speak up about race. I thought that if I spoke up about race and asked questions about the demographics of people served, more specifically the number of African Americans served, that I would be viewed as playing the race card, or that I was trying to make white people feel uncomfortable, or that I was being passive aggressive and calling people racist. Throughout the course of the African American Leadership Academy, we were given articles to read, and we would discuss those articles in great detail. It was through these discussions that I became comfortable in my skin, with my identity as a poor black gay man from the South. I want to share with you a brief portion of two articles that have stuck with me since my experience with the Academy. I think the two articles will speak to both your heart and your head. The first excerpt is from Mark D. Jordan and is titled, Telling Truths in Church, Scandal, Flesh, and Christian Speech. Truth-telling is not simple. It is not like the Norman Rockwell painting in which a ruggedly handsome white man speaks to the town meeting at his white clapboard church while other white men wearing ties listen in admiration. Truth-telling isn't like that. Truth speakers don't often radiate handsome honesty. They are disconcerting and diverse rather than comfortably familiar. So as I got comfortable in my own skin and got comfortable with myself as a leader, I saw myself as a truth speaker. A truth speaker for poor people. A truth speaker for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people of color. The second article I would like to share with you was written by Jonathan Tylove in 2005, and is titled, Black Gender Gap Hits Nearly 2 Million. Black adult women outnumber black men by nearly 2 million in America. Stark testimony to how often black men die before their time. Worse yet, with nearly another million black men in prison or in the military, the reality in most black communities across the country is of an even greater imbalance, a gap of 2.8 million or 26%. The comparable disparity for whites was 8%. If white men were falling off the grid as rapidly as black men, it would be considered a national crisis. And this was a quote by Raymond Winbush, who's with the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University in Baltimore. Exponentially higher rates of homicide and AIDS play their part, especially among younger black men. Even more deadly through middle age and beyond are higher rates of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and cancer. Death rates for black men exceeded those for white men in every state with a sizable black community. In Ohio, the death rate for black men was nearly 32%. Higher than that of our white counterparts. These statistics are alarming, and as a truth speaker, I cannot and I will not be silent. I must and I shall speak up about race. So from my experience with the African American Leadership Academy, it became most evident to me that I, as a poor black gay man, had to become comfortable in my identity. Comfortable with my self-esteem, because if I don't speak up and advocate for folks that are poor, black, and gay like me, who will? Therefore, I assert to you that the answers to the questions of when and why to speak up about race are quite simply, whenever speaking up advances understanding, acceptance, and justice. And why? Because it is the right thing to do. Thank you.
Good morning. I have a long name. My name is Verdina Runningbrook Medicine Woman Who Walks Far, Lee. And before I was Verdina, well, before I was Running Brook, before I was Medicine Woman Who Walks Far, I was a person just like you, and I'm honored to be in your presence and happy to be so welcomed by you today. I am a physician. I am a director of a human rights advocacy group. I unfortunately did not bring cards, but the name of my organization is Imani Works. And Imani is a wonderful word that means faith in many different languages. And at Imani Works, we believe that faith does work, as evidenced by you here today. When asked to speak on this topic, all of the thoughts that have passed through the people who spoke before me passed through my mind, and it was difficult to come up with what to say. But I hope that by the power of the Great Spirit, you will hear with the same spirit with which I feel these words, which is in love. Everyone does it. It makes life a little easier if we can ignore it, lay it down for just a moment. If we can close our eyes and choose not to speak about the most divisive aspect of our lives as citizens of the United States, we do it. As a nation, we run from the conversation of race. We wrap it in more comfortable and familiar struggles with less legacy, less economic injustice, or social impact. But this is false. After all, when have you seen a federal reservation for middle-aged executive men, gay or straight? Slums for bankers? Or Martha Stewart in a place like Marysville? I could list statistics for you about the rate of incarceration for blacks in the U.S., and we heard some wonderful statistics just a moment ago. I could name the common diseases that kill migrant workers that could be cured by the antibiotics that you didn't finish when you visited the last doctor in your neighborhood. I could tell you that the list of Native American women who have been abducted without a trace over the past two decades grows at an alarming rate, faster than the current white slavery that is so often compared to the shame of the transatlantic slave trade. We live in a land of superlatives. So one oppressed group will always find a way to one up the next. As a country, we want the best, the fastest, the longest, the highest, the worst, and the most degrading to compare. That is our nature. Because we live in a land of such unfettered wealth, even the poorest of us can go to our local library and search the statistics on the internet for free. But what good would it do to list these atrocities if we are finding ways to not see, hear, or speak about color, even among our friends? Look at your neighborhood. Look at your job, your school, your place of worship, your family. These are the places that you and your children spend the majority of your time. Do you see significant color there? Am I preaching Jesus' message of love your neighbor as yourself to the choir? Of course I am. And believe me, I'm not here to condemn. I applaud you this day for sharing this conversation. So many would shrink back from this encounter without a hesitation. Great courage is needed to face the things that we speak about openly today. And I thank you. I encourage you to embrace your neighbor as you embrace yourself. Tolerance is a word that I don't tolerate well because it connotes that I'll put up with you. It has nothing to do with acceptance. But it is a step. If you're not able to embrace your neighbor, perhaps the problem lies in embracing the thing about yourself that sets you apart from the mainstream, which is so worshipped in our culture. That thing that helps you to stand out and be unique. Perhaps seeing the uniqueness in someone else frightens you about the uniqueness you may see in yourself that lends to true diversity. As you begin to enjoy what makes you unique, only then will you begin to be able to enjoy the uniqueness of others. As we step out into uncharted waters of race in our country, I'm sure we have fear offending one another when we mean no harm. Yet this is a risk we have to be willing to take. It is the cost of struggling together instead of against one another. With that, I leave you with a story of my ancestors' experience with integrated worship as far back as the 1940s. My mother tells me this story often. The Azusa Street experience of the Holy Spirit had sparked Pentecostals across the country decades before white evangelists would frequent the small congregation of black Pentecostals made primarily of my mother's family and the neighbors that she shared in the Appalachian Mountains of southern Kentucky. He was unaware that centuries before, blacks celebrated the Holy Spirit in secret places, crowded around pails of water, in the hopes that their joyful sounds would be absorbed by the water and muffled from the ears of the overseers. This evangelist was a regular visitor who worshiped and rejoiced with my family as if it were his own. He was so comfortable sharing the same beliefs in an everlasting life of worship and praise with brothers and sisters from every walk of life. One day, when asked to speak, he joyfully announced, "When we all get to heaven, your soul's going to be as white as mine." To the surprise of the adults and the chuckles of the children, the man realized his faux pas and continued to rejoice with the congregants. His error was accepted by all, even the giggling children. May we all be so bold to risk as he did, loving one another in the best way we know how. Thank you.
Every event our racial diversity task force has organized so far facilitated interracial conversations. But we've also highlighted what I like to call diversity 2.0, where race, religion, language, sexual orientation, and economic class intertwine, often inseparably, like spaghetti. Unitarian Universalism, with its emphasis on individual worth and dignity and interconnectedness, is uniquely suited to handle diversity 2.0, or you may want to call it 21st century pluralism. So theoretically, we're all set. On the practice front, thanks to the UUA's focus on public witness through programs like Standing on the Side of Love, the task force has received an energy boost. But our work ahead will have to blaze new trails. In Ohio, progressives are now caught in a perfect storm of a recession combined with regressive politics. In this climate, with a projected $8 billion state budget shortfall, the poor, the people of color, and the immigrants, who already have grossly unequal access to healthcare, education, justice, and so on, will be asked to sacrifice even more, while raising taxes on the super rich seems to be out of the question. LGBT issues will also be pushed to the back burner. But the urgency of the situation also presents us with an opportunity to build a firm foundation for a healthy, interconnected community. We can do this by focusing on two things: allies and coalitions. Allies are those who may not be directly affected by an issue, but know that anything that hurts a neighbor ultimately hurts them. So they will educate themselves on issues like immigration, homophobia, sexism, and racism. They will then join others in governance from the bottom up to influence public policy. If you're straight and white, you will be an important ally. You are the equivalent of the rare type O blood, a much-needed universal donor of moral support. We need all blood types, though. Within the next few weeks, for example, members of the Gay-Straight Alliance and the Racial Diversity Task Force plan to meet with Senator Voinovich's representative to make a final push to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It will be good to have a mix of people. We also need to build new coalitions. For example, in the Columbus area, we plan to start a dialogue between NAACP and LGBT organizations like New Leaf, HRC, and Equality Ohio. Agencies that fight poverty in the rural Appalachia should be working hand in hand with urban organizations. Together, we will have the numbers and the soul force, as Gandhi called it, to take on this perfect storm. If you're willing to help as an ally on any issue of your choice, please add your name to the sign-up sheet on the greeters table on your way out. We are proud and grateful that on this difficult and spiritual journey, we can count on you as companions. Please, let's not give up now or sit on the sidelines, because we are our brother's keepers and we are our sister's caretakers. Namaste.